Art and Science.
A radio broadcast about the European Digital Art and Science Network.
Hello and welcome to the fourth part of the Art and Science radio broadcast. In today's radio broadcast, you will hear parts of the symposium Future Mobility, a Challenge for Art and Science, which took place during the Ars Electronica Festival 2015. How will the city of the future look like and how should our living environments develop? One thing at least is clear, mobility will be one of the major issues in this regard. For one thing, different types of mobility and on the other hand also movement itself. Because in the end mobility is nothing more or less than movement. In the symposium Future Mobility, a Challenge for Art and Science during the Ars Electronica Festival on Friday the 4th September, the questions went from how will the car of the future look like to how do we get people to move back to the villages or how should the post-refugee city look like. There are so many directions of research concerning the individual and the public mobility and also the question how they should be organized in the future. Parts of the symposium you will hear in today's radio show. The speakers on the floor were Alexander Mankowski from Germany, he is futurologist at Mercedes, also Marina Mara, she is from Austria and responsible for robopsychology at Ars Electronica Future Lab. Then there were the speakers Shunyi Yamanaka from Japan, he is technical designer and professor in the Interfacial Initiative in Information Studies at the University of Tokyo, and Takayuki Furuta, also from Japan and leader of the Robot Development Program of Japan Science and Technology Agency. Then there also was Hiroshi Ishii from Japan, he's from MIT Media Lab, and Wu Ning from China, he's an artist and lives in the village of Bishan, where he founded the Bishan Commune in the year 2011, which works as an intellectual circle for the revival of the rural areas in China. And last but not least, there was Kilian Kleinschmidt from Germany, who was once camp manager from the UNHCR. On a microphone greeting you, Sarah Praschak.
Residential, commercial and industrial areas all have been separated for greater efficiency and greater convenience. A quarter of a mile high skyscrapers tower with convenient rest and recreational facilities for all. On many of the buildings are landing decks for helicopters and other gyros.
This is a part of a commercial from Belgrade's Magic Motorways from the year 1939 about what future mobility will look like.
Modern and efficient city planning, breathtaking architecture, each city block a complete unit in itself. Here is an important intersection in the great metropolis of 1960. Elevated sidewalks give a new measure of safety and convenience to pedestrians. They actually double the available width for traffic in the street.
The man who presented this commercial was the first speaker of the symposium about future mobility, Alexander Mankowski from Mercedes. He presented the, as they say, car of the future called Mercedes F015 during the Ars Electronica Festival and talked about future studies and brainstorming. First, he cited Dieter Zetscher, chairman of Daimler AG, with the following words.
Anyone who focuses solely on technology has not yet grasped how autonomous driving will change our societies.
So it's not just about developing technology, it's also about the influences these technologies have on our society. One of the most important things is to discuss these developments together. Futurologists should proceed in three steps, Alexander Mankowski said. The first step is learning, the second one exploring, and last but not least, going out into the world and doing it. He also cited the American mathematician Norbert Wiener.
One of the great future problems we have faced is the relation between man and machine.
Alexander Mankowski has the opinion that not the man should get used to the machine, but the machine to the man. He also said that every one of us should ask the question, what are my talents as a human being and what of them do I want to pass to machine? What do I want to automate and what not? One of the main conditions of the Mercedes F015 should be luxury in motion, he said. Alexander Mankowski also talked about the competition or also maybe the possible cooperation between the automobile industry and the IT industry.
I see these autonomous technologies as a kind of a collective innovation. Yeah, collective innovation means it's like kind of a grassroots now. Yeah, it's like the springtime. Everything is green. Everywhere it's green, it's not Google, it's are the suppliers, universities, even cities, individuals, everywhere has it gone, yeah? So we have to think about what is our competitive advantage, what can we contribute as Mercedes-Benz? What we can contribute is first of all to make a whole product, the design, the package, the car, yeah? To visualize what this future will be, this is one thing, it's not digital at all, it's the physical thing. What we can contribute are concepts like what I tried to tell, put them, what are human talents? Yeah, human talents, it's to look at this is typical for us, yeah, because we are dealing with customers, with people all the time, with desires and so on. Yeah, so I think our contribution, a special contribution, is to bring in these communication aspect. This I didn't see at the other parties. Yeah, most of them are doing networked perfect computers or looking for artificial intelligence or something, yeah, or cards and mapping, yeah. But we are these interaction process. That's our special contribution, but nevertheless we have to deal with the maps and the sensors too, but it makes no sense that we develop the best sensor. Yeah, there are others do that better than me. But it's a contribution, you see, it's a collective innovation and we are one player. And we have specialties, talents like the design and the interaction, human interface inside the car and outside the car.
The philosopher and mathematician Rafael Capuro once said, "The motorist of the 20th century no longer exists, and the one of the 21st century has not been invited yet." So one thing is clear, future mobility and also the robot car raises many questions. For example, how will it feel to be surrounded by swarms of mobility robots? How will you be able to trust a self-driving car? How will the self-driving car interact with its passengers? Which signal will replace eye contact with a human driver? And also, how will the self-driving car communicate externally, for example, with cyclists? After the lecture about future mobility from Alexander Mankowski, Marina Mara from the Ars Electronica Future Lab, which also did a research collaboration with Mercedes-Benz, stepped on the lectern and talked about exactly that questions. Her research is about so-called robot psychology, and she talked about fundamental challenges for human-robot relationships. Because, first of all, it's about designing robots that way so that humans can also accept them as parts of their lives. So it's about designing positive interaction experiences with robots, creating likable tools instead of replacing human beings, building human-robot teams instead of dominant technology, and also increasing user acceptance and trust by communication. So they created two experiment fields, so-called shared space pixels and also shared space bots. In the experiment of shared space pixels, robotic mobility can be experienced with three quadrocopters equipped with LED models. In a camera and sensors-based interaction space, the pixel represents different traffic scenarios and communicate via light signal or defined flight movements with people in their environment. And the people can also interact with them, for example, with signs with the hands. In the experiment of shared space bots, specially developed ground robots are used to test current approaches to human-car interaction of the future. Each of the six robots can be augmented by ground projection. By an upward LED eye and an all-round running LED ring, it is possible for the bots to communicate current states to the outside, for example, whether and in what direction they perceive a human interaction partner. Some early learnings they took from these experiences are proactive communication by self-driving cars will constitute an essential precondition for pleasant human-machine interaction. Light signals seem to be useful means of communication. Interpretation of gestures entails various challenges, but some simple arm motions seem to be an intuitive from communication. But this, so the question, what gesture means what, of course also depends on cultural backgrounds. But all this information also raises the question, what do we have to learn in the future? Does every child need to know several signs? How will these concepts work in the future? Alexander Mankowski answered this question with the following words.
It will be a kind of development that we all have to learn, children, especially children, we too, have to learn to interact with not only with the autonomous car, with the automated car, but with everything what is automated around us. Yeah, imagine your delivery drone, yeah, and then you shall be able to interact with the drone too. Yeah, maybe say here I am, huh? My packet, or say no, beware. So there will be a phase where we have to learn, not codes, but simple signs, like Martina said, like for example, if you stand on the side of the road and you like to cross, or you're just standing there, then take a step back. It's not a hierarchy. It's a kind of a teamwork, yeah? It's not a hierarchy and the machine is a slave and I'm the master and so on. That's not the case. It's a kind of a teamwork because the machinery is there to help us. It's like a domesticated animal, yeah? As Clifford Ness from Stanford says, the psychologist there, like a domesticated animal, like a dog. He said the example of a dog. The dog is very helpful, but you have to understand the animal a little bit, yeah? Or on horse, we have to understand the horse a little bit. Then it's very helpful, but otherwise it kicks you. In case of the robot, yeah, mobile robot like a car, it should be very, very simple and intuitive to read the intentions of the car. Mm. It's better than today, because today if you have a car and you can't see the driver anyway because of maybe it's blackened out or something, today you can't see if the car is accelerating or not. Mm. Yeah, in these cars, then you will have a clear sign that the car is accelerating, and then it's your choice to understand what to do. You are responsible. Even a child 9 years old, they are not totally dumb. Yeah, they can check that, but they have to see it. Yeah, it's a concept of informed trust instead of blind trust. Today it's more blind trust.
The problem which stays is, of course, that it's always possible to hack electronic devices. So, of course, it's also possible to hack self-driving cars, for example. Yeah, so much about future mobility in the classical scenario, but mobility hasn't always to do with traffic. It can also stand for movement. So after Hiroshi Ishii, one of the masterminds from MIT Media Lab in the 90s, held a lecture, and Shunyi Yamanaka and Takayuki Furuta from Japan presented new robotic ideas and concepts, Hu Ning, an artist from China, stepped on stage and talked about movement in the sense of getting people to move back to the villages and the country. Hu Ning works in exactly those areas which were left by people which are moving to the cities. His intention is to create spaces in those villages so people are required to move back to the country. He said he hopes he can get more and more people within his artistic work to move back to the land. The next and also last speaker for the symposium about future mobility was Kilian Kleinschmidt. He talked about his work as camp manager and explained about the situation of refugees. He also worked together with Lukas Maximilian Hüller, Hannes Seebacher and Robert Pöcksteiner. They jointly launched the Let the Children Play initiative. Let the Children Play is an effort to visualize ethnic values in keeping with the United Nations guidelines for the protection and promotion of fundamental human rights and the rights of children. In cooperation with numerous artists worldwide, this initiative has produced several projects having to do with games and playing. The point of departure was Children's Games, a painting by Peter Bruegel the Elder from the year 1560, which Lukas M. Hüller updated by means of elaborately staged photographic settings in various countries throughout the world. Kilian Kleinschmidt also talked about Satari. Satari is a refugee camp in northern Jordan, about 10 kilometers east of Mafraq and 6 kilometers south of the Syrian border. It is one of the largest refugee camps and becoming a municipal solid. So there is a main street with market stalls and shops. Meanwhile, it is Jordan's fourth largest city. Since July 2012, people there find refuge from the civil war in Syria. It is estimated that the camp has about 79,000 inhabitants. Responsible for them is the UNHCR. Head of the settlement was the German development worker Kilian Kleinschmidt. One of his self-imposed tasks is to define areas and to assign street names so that every refugee has a unique address. Numerous organizations such as Doctors Without Borders are active in Satari. Schools were built, a football field applied. The German Agency for Technical Relief cared with over 100 employees for shared kitchens, toilets and wastewater. Kilian Kleinschmidt talked about his work there and also about how he thinks the global refugee management should work in the future.
Refugee camps is a story in itself. And we will have to think about refugee camps in a different way, as right now we know even Europe is again faced with a major refugee crisis, which we perceive as a threat, rather seeing it as an opportunity. And I will take you now, for the few minutes I have with you, through what it means to change from an approach of refugee camps as a threat, as in fact a storage facility for things, and you unpack them months and years later, into an opportunity. On the 29th of July 2012, there was a piece of a desert. And that piece of the desert was designated by the government of Jordan, together with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, to become a refugee camp. And what happened there was humanitarian organizations, non-governmental organizations under the coordination of UNHCR setting up tents. We had up to 3,000 people coming in one night. So that's what is happening when there's an emergency. Tents, water, the famous 18 liters of clean water per day per person, which is the humanitarian standard. That's what you flushed down in one toilet go this morning yourself in Austria or somewhere else. Tents and rows, communal toilets, communal showers, communal kitchens once you have issued the first hot meals. That is how we see and we perceive refugee crisis response, dealing with many people in distress, many people who have lost everything. We try to make them all the same. We make them into 100,000 times the same as it was in the camp. They eat the same, they dress the same, they live the same way, and so on. Now one big discovery, and that was happening very fast in Zaatari, 10 kilometers from the Syrian border in northern Jordan. 10 kilometers from the war. We could hear the war. Something was happening. The people rebelled. The people actually rebelled against what they perceived as inhuman. Inhuman because it was standardizing everybody and putting everybody in the space into the category, now you're a refugee, now you all live the same way. You all forget about your identity, forget about being people, forget about human beings, you're now a number, your registration number. You have a card which entitles you to certain things. So that's what happened. And in their minds, they said, what's wrong with these people? Why are they trying to tell us how we have to dress, to eat, and so on? So they started to do something we considered as criminal. They connected the electricity wires to the public lighting system we had up there, because it's easy, two wires and you have electricity. They moved the tents as they felt the space should be designed. They tried to create individual space. And suddenly each house looked differently. And then these containers were donated to replace the tents by many, many countries, each container about 2,000 euros, but great stuff. But what they didn't accept was to keep the container actually as a container. They actually used the pieces of the containers to put it together into different shapes. So all of that showed us one thing. Actually, the urge, the desire to come back to what is an individual human being. I have a different house from my neighbor. My curtain looks differently. Look what fountain I have built. It is actually a sign of home away from home. The toilets was a big battle. Hundreds of communal toilets. So what they did, they dismantled over 90 buildings. They destroyed them. So we called it vandalism, but they called it privatization because they took the building materials and made their own toilets with them. It's logical, we would do the same. Not more than 15 months later, we saw this. When I left the camp, I quit the United Nations last year on the 31st of October, there were 3,000 businesses. The Champs-Élysées had expanded, the camp had several axes, which always actually had these type of incredible commerces, including a major supermarket with about $300,000 investment by some Syrians who said, well, we want a real supermarket. We also estimated the monthly turnover at about 10 to 12 million euros within the market. We had a travel agency. You could book actually your travel. Especially for those who were working abroad. There were some members of families working in the Gulf States, sending money back home into the camp. They were actually organizing their travel with this travel agency. He didn't have a very good internet connection. He did it all by phone, but he did organize travel. So within, let's say, at that moment, 2 years, out of that piece of desert, we had a full city. So now, of course, the questions arise of what does it mean in the context of global refugee management? I mean, we're talking about Burning Man cities coming and going. We're talking about the number of other festivals in the world where you have somewhere in India, I believe, 4 million people coming and baff, and within a few hours you have a city and then it disappears again. Governments, however, somehow accept when it's the Burning Man or when it's a religious festival that you're setting up structures which resemble urban management, urban delivery of assistance or of services. But when it comes to refugees, they all get nervous. And I can say that every time I use the word city for what had clearly become a city, even though the houses didn't maybe look like Vienna, every time I used the word city, the government of Jordan wrote a letter to the United Nations and saying, he did it again, he said it again. But it was a city. What we also learned in there was that humanitarian organizations like my own, like UNICEF, like all the many NGOs who you will see the appeals right now, especially for the region, for the Middle East, and the Syria crisis had absolutely no experience to manage this type of situation. I mean, who was I to call myself the mayor of Zaatari? I had never been a mayor in my life. Yet I had managed camps, but I'd never managed a city. So what I felt was that we have to actually move and change our way of bringing capacities in such places to run them professionally.
So they brought expertise, meaning city planners, from the city of Amsterdam into the camp. The job was, for example, stuff like redesigning the water system, the planning of transportation and so on. But this experience failed because Amsterdam city planners didn't understand that what had to be done is to move fast.
Because these people, the people we are now talking about in the news every day, now coming across oceans and, I mean, Mediterranean seas and coming in with trucks, these people have an incredible energy. They couldn't wait until a city planner had finished planning, until the transport planner had finished planning. So they set up their own transportation systems. They were continuing to and actually to develop their own ways of organizing their habitat and organizing the areas. So there was, for us, a constant sort of balance between trying to have a managed process versus a self-managed reorganization of everything else. It was with water the same thing. We discovered that they were actually already doing water distribution systems because they had invested into washing machines. So again, learning how to balance between a structured and managed process and a self-organized way of doing it, giving the space to do it when trying to guide it, was one of the keys. We also had one of the principles, and this is something we're forgetting when we look at the victims of crisis. What I'm appealing usually to people who work with that in that context and look at it and saying, put a moment aside why they're here. Just look into the fact that human beings who actually live in a given space, and that space needs to be managed. And it should be managed in a sustainable manner so that we actually keep people accountable for what they're doing within their space. So I was actually, I think, the first one who said a refugee in that refuge city should be actually paying for electricity, should have a prepaid meter in his home, and even though when most of them are actually poor and may not be able to pay for it, still be held accountable for the electricity the family is using. And the same way for water. Instead of wasting water without being held accountable, make people accountable for it. What's wrong with this? It's not because you're a refugee, you're actually sick, or you are actually totally disabled in a way of not being capable of being respected as a human being, as a citizen in this case, of a refuge city. We have seen many, many settlements in the world, and just for your information, the average lifespan, or the average stay of a refugee in one of these big settlements, in Kenya, in Congo, in anywhere, is now, unfortunately, 17 years. So I think it's worthwhile to begin to invest into something which is not just an emergency response, something where you keep people alive, but to invest into something more long-term, so it becomes actually a win-win for the people, a chance for change, and for the surroundings in that context. So we are seeing displacement and refuge obviously as a crisis, but let's turn the crisis into opportunities. And I think that is what matters also in the current very emotional and at times unnecessary European debate on what we should do and how much we should close or open our borders. Thank you very much.
This was the last speaker of the symposium about future mobility, a challenge for art and science, Kilian Kleinschmidt. The creator of today's radio show, Art and Science Part 4, was me, Sarah Braschak, who's greeting you and wishing you a nice day. The next Art and Science radio broadcast will be on the 28th October by Yania Savets. Art and Science.
A radio broadcast about the European Digital Art and Science Network.